What I want to say to you, my beloved, this evening, I have borrowed from holy people who counsel us that if we want to reach the resurrection, the joy, and salvation, we must necessarily accept, in this world, to pass through a Golgotha of our own. All the people who will ever be saved will have to pass through Holy Week in this world. People who live in this world without tribulations, without adversities, without temptations, without persecutions, without illnesses, without mourning, these people do not have much of a relationship with God. Of course, some call them blessed. He is making a life. He is living well. He is having a good time. But that is not the question. Where he will go, that is the question. And why should this man not suffer at all, and have his days pass so pleasantly, while another's days are all bitterness and all mourning clothes? This is the question that ought to occupy a person. So the matter has two sides, as I see it. It has the side that we should, with patient endurance, with perseverance, and even with love, accept the tribulations that come upon us in this world, provided, of course, that we are not creating them ourselves through our egotism and our carelessness. Or else, if there is no cross, we should say, "Why, Lord, are we without a cross? How is it that you go carrying your own cross and we draw near to you without a cross?" This is something that should occupy a person. For Christ told us, "If anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Consequently, there is no such thing as a follower of Jesus who does not carry a cross. If you read the lives of the saints of the fathers, you must have come across, in an account of Saint Macarius the Great of Egypt, the following incident. He was once going down to the city with his disciple. When they came near the city, on the right side of the road they found a woman weeping and wailing. The saint, without even paying attention, kept on his way. But the young disciple, still inexperienced, instead of following the elder's example and saying to himself, "The elder knows better whether we should stop or not," interrupted him and said, "Abba, there is a woman crying here." "Yes, my child," he replied, "she is crying, but she is a woman. Let us continue on our way." "Yes," said the young man, "she is a woman, but she is a creature of God. Yes, my child, but she is a woman." Still the young man would not let it go. He kept insisting until the elder took this too as perhaps a voice from God and turned back. "I will obey," he said. "I will show love. Let us go and see why she is crying." In any case, they approached the woman, and in some way in which God enlightened them, they tried to draw out why she was weeping, and whether they, as fellow human beings, might help her in this difficult situation that was bringing her to such tears. In any case, for a long while they could not get a single word out of her to learn why she was weeping. She kept on weeping and wailing. They came to the point of leaving empty-handed, and she turns and says this, "Go on your way, my elder," she says. "You cannot help me." Once she had opened her mouth, they took courage and tried to bring out from within her, to coax out, as I told you, what was happening. "I told you, go on your way, you cannot help me. Let us hear what is happening to you, and from there we will see whether we can help you or not. God placed us here on your road, perhaps through us as well. God has some way to help you, to dry up these tears, to dry them for you." "Well then, listen," she says, "to what is happening to me. God has abandoned me. A strange thing, but my child, since you are breathing, since your breast still beats, how has God abandoned you?" "Abba, for 3 years I have had no temptation to face. God has abandoned me." "Go on your way." She was weeping because for 3 years her affairs had been going well. She had not wept, had not been distressed, had not found herself in any difficult moment. Everything ran like clockwork. Everything went beautifully. This, for her, was abandonment by God. How is the modern person today to understand such things, and how to believe, and how to be willing to enter the yoke of Christ, and to accept the temptations, to accept the crosses of this world? For no one knows what comes out from behind that tear, from that pain, from that setback. A person does not know what comes of it. Could anyone have imagined that behind the crosses there is resurrection, that behind the tomb there is life, that behind Golgotha there is light? Who could have believed such a thing? Even the devil himself could not understand it, and that is why he raised Christ up onto the cross, to get him out of the way. His malice could see only that far. What would come out behind it? The salvation of the whole human race, and the crushing of his own head that he did not see. Evidently it was on the basis of such thoughts that an anonymous soul wrote the following words. And it says, "Whoever refuses to accept the cross and the affliction that God gives him will later find himself compelled to bear a much heavier burden, made heavier still by impatience, indignation, and inconsolable turmoil." This refers to what God gives him, because many people create difficult situations for themselves. It is not speaking about those. For if the crosses, tears, hardships, afflictions, and adversities found in the world were truly examined, it would be discovered that in 99 cases out of 100, they are made by our own hands. We made them ourselves. God did not give them to us. You see a woman abandoned with 2 or 3 children. Where is the husband? He took up with another woman and left for Germany, left for America. He left behind him, as you can understand, a situation fit for tears. Where did you find this man? Who gave him to you? No answer. Did God give him to you? God did not give him to you. So this was not your own Adam. That is exactly why there was no cooperation, no harmony. He did not understand you, and you did not understand him. You reached out your own hand and took him. You did not listen to your father, nor to your mother, nor to anyone. You did things your own way, and now you're paying for it, paying for what you yourself made. You found a young woman. You say, "I found a young woman, a maiden on paper, but not in reality, a maiden with a child in her arms and another in her womb, completely unmarried, a dreadful situation," as you'll realize when you hear it and see where she lives. How did she come to that? Where is the state, she asks. What use is the state in a case like this? Where is the church? What is it supposed to do? Head off the fornication and the adultery and the corruption. Whatever it is that happens to you, you expect the church to come. You wait for the church and the Christian to come. But what good does it do? Once we have to take the children, one from the womb and one from her arms, what good can come of it down there? Since you have put yourself outside the law of God, since you have sinned against God's way, and your tears and your pain and your afflictions, and this whole state that you feel choking you, even all of this you made with your own hands, you never once asked God. I found another man ruined the same way. His business partner devoured everything the very next day, a first-class swindler. This man had taken his wife's dowry, and without asking anyone, just to make easy money, because the other one had told him, "Here you'll earn 300%, so that he might get rich, if possible. In a single week, he handed it all over. He had some debts. He clears the debts, pays them off, takes the remainder and flies the coop. Out on the street, where are you going to find the woman? And what is she to do? Kill herself, throw herself away. But why would you blow your brains out? I don't understand it. God is wicked," he says. "It is God's fault. Did he ask God at all? I tell you, he consulted neither a lawyer nor a notary nor anyone, faced with easy profit. He rushed in so as not to miss the chance." That, I imagine, is how it was, and that is exactly how it was. If our afflictions are examined, I say, we'll see that they come from our own hands. I found a mother who had lost a girl and a boy. God is cruel, and so on. They had fallen into the Pineios River. You'll have read about it in the newspaper. Sunday morning with her boyfriend and his girlfriend, two of them, brother and sister, a boy and a girl, each one had brought someone, one his girlfriend, the other his boyfriend, because, you see, sin pairs people up, so that even a brother and sister will go along together for their own destruction. Sunday morning, off they went to the devil. They fell into the Pineios. They drowned. God's to blame. Supposedly it is God's fault. They had sprouted wings, these young ones, like the ants that grow wings, only to be lost. How is God to blame? Did anyone ever speak to these children about God? They were spoken to, and they didn't listen. The responsibility is theirs. They will give an account. And indeed, God may have been holding them back from even greater sins. They were at fault themselves. They did their reckless things. Examine matters like these. Look behind every pain, every affliction, every hardship, and see what is really going on. People who never thought things through seriously went into business, came to ruin. They built. They bought. I don't know what all they did. They married off children. They went into trade and created whole situations, created crosses, as we say, and now they can't cut them away. God is not to blame. Perhaps in 1 or 2% of cases a real temptation may be found. I work honestly, I work morally, I work as nature allows. I'm careful about my diet, I don't wreck my health. I sleep the hours a person needs. I do myself no other harm and commit no excesses. And yet a cancer comes to visit me, one that I did not bring on myself, that I could not have made. That is a temptation, that is a temptation. It is a cross. And together with the cross Christ gives you, if you need it, he will also give you the patient endurance and the strength you need to bear it so that you do not blaspheme God because of your sufferings. And if you do blaspheme God, it is like spitting at the sun or throwing stones at the sun. The stones will only fall back upon your own head. God loses nothing by it. The world blasphemes him, the mindless world. But it is for your own good, because together with the temptation, he says, God also gives the way out. Read the first epistle to the Corinthians and see what it says there. So I say, and it makes a deep impression on me. Here he says, whoever refuses to accept the crosses and the affliction that God offers him, not the ones he makes for himself, but the ones God offers him, will one day find himself in a harder place still, because God sometimes permits a temptation for a person's own good. Some time ago, in another talk we had, if I'm not mistaken, I told you of an incident with a mother who had only one daughter, a girl with a real gift. She had a fine voice, and the mother decided to send her abroad on a scholarship to Italy. Indeed, everything was arranged for her to rise to the top, to reach the level of Callas in those days, all the way to La Scala in Milan. The mother would even say, quite charmed with herself, that in a few years Callas would be nothing compared to this daughter, and when everything had been arranged for her to fly with Ty, the old name for Olympic, they had agreed that the car would come for her in the morning to take her to the company so she could fly off to Italy. She was found paralyzed in her bed. You can understand what followed, not because the girl had fallen ill, but because the opportunity was being lost. That is how the mother saw it, and the mother went so far as to think of suicide. As it turned out, instead of Italy, the daughter found herself in the Asclepian Hospital at Vula. It was the month of September, and the mother paced back and forth, up and down, already dressed in mourning, and she blasphemed God, who in his supposed malice had cut off her daughter's good fortune. But in his love, God stretched out his hand to save both the girl and her mother, for the girl would certainly have been ruined. She might have made money, but in that kind of life it was only natural that a young child would be destroyed, in ways known to God. These are not matters we should treat as though they were nothing. They are of great importance. A group of women used to go there and speak, and the young girl heard that there was another way of seeing things, that God is love, and that whenever God intervenes, he does so out of love to prevent a greater disaster and all the rest. And so she began to believe. And when we entered the season of the Triodion, the ladies who spoke there encouraged anyone who wished to go to confession, receive Holy Communion and so forth, in preparation for Pascha. This little girl, lying there paralyzed, had a condition that no doctor could diagnose. The child had no illness at all. God had confined her to bed in order to save her, and to save her mother as well. I'm describing to you one kind of temptation that God, glory be to him, gives us many times in order to spare us something worse. So the girl begged her mother to believe as well, I am certain, she says, Mama, that if you believe in Christ, make your confession and ask forgiveness for the curses you have hurled at him until now, and thank him because he put out his hand and saved me from a destruction that was coming. You can be certain that we will celebrate Pascha together at home. I will not celebrate Pascha here. Of course, this sounded like a fairy tale to her mother. In any case, the outcome was that the child received Holy Communion during Holy Week. And on the afternoon of Great Friday, the mother went down there, intending also to leave her the candle of the resurrection, since on Saturday she would not be coming down. And when she went down, she found her standing, and the little girl welcomed her at the door, and she took her and they left. And they came back on Tuesday of Pascha and received the discharge papers. This hand of God, when something happens to a person that he did not bring about himself, he ought to say, Lord, what do you want to teach me? Tell me, what is this about? Why do you seize me by the foot? Why do you cut my wings? Why do you take away my movement, my strength, my fuel? What do you want? What is this about? Teach me. But instead we turn and accuse him when he lays his hand exactly where he knows. At that point I mentioned that TAFE Light, from Orestiada, a major boarded with his wife and his two girls, to come to Alexandroupolis and catch the plane for Athens. And on the way the car breaks down, the jeep that was carrying him. And the major began to blaspheme against the most holy Theotokos at the soldier, who quickly got down to change the tire and so on to get him there. But they missed the plane, and then the curses against the most holy Theotokos multiplied. The soldier was not at fault. A flat tire caught him. What was the young man's fault? Yet shortly afterward, they learned that at Malakasa the plane went down. And that plane crashed then, and at that the major swallowed his tongue. It seems that one of his children, some one of them, must have been good and pure, and God did not desire this man's own death either, and he gave him this lesson and permitted him to take that loss there, so that he would not be aboard, because no one survived then. If, in the many matters which we find difficult, dark, upside down, and so on, the causes and the reason they were permitted are sought out, we will marvel at the providence of God, and we will kiss his feet for the things he permits. Because many times when there is no tribulation, we become outward turned. The most beautiful prayers, the best prayers, the most powerful prayers, the ones that reach the throne of God and send the divine grace back down upon us, are the ones offered when there are tribulations. When science abandons us, when our security abandons us, when everything abandons us, then comes the cry, my most holy Theotokos, help. Then come the vows, then come the offerings, then come the tears, then come those on their knees, and no one goes to Christ with carnations in hand and with bouquets. No one. No one goes to Christ that way. Then we simply keep him off to the side as a servant for our difficult moments. And after that, he himself, his most holy mother, and the saints are kept outside the house, and people go on living their lives. They keep them as decorative figures. So whoever, he says, is unwilling to bear the cross, will bear it further on much more obscurely, without any good results. For this reason, none of us, not one of us, should create such situations for himself, because he can scarcely endure them. This is a difficult thing, and that is precisely why he taught us in the Lord's Prayer to say to him, lead us not into temptation. But if he does lead us into temptation, if he allows us to enter into temptation for reasons known to him, because he knows what is beneficial for us, then we should not ask him to take away the temptation, to take away the cross, but to give us the strength to bear it. Since you are permitting this cross for me, Lord, you have your reason. Therefore, I do not want you to take it from me, but give me the strength to endure it. But I tell you, many times I hear certain people speak foolishly. They have a great cross, they say. There is a household that has a maladjusted child, as we put it, maladjusted just as elsewhere there is a priest who has fathered a girl with horns on her head. These are great temptations, great crosses in these homes. But if the matters are examined behind the scenes, we will find that they made them themselves, both the one case and the other. That great affair of the priest, which remained a mystery to the world, was unraveled by a demon-possessed woman, who said, "Priest, why does the child have the horns on its head? Did you ever ask your God why? For him to tell you, when did you conceive it, priest?"
"On the Annunciation?"
"Yes, on the very day of the Annunciation."
"Did you grasp that? What did he want to bring out for you, priest?
And if these things are examined behind the scenes, many things will be found. First cousins married to each other. What will they bring forth? Ask science to speak to you about incest, and see what you will bring forth.
Look at all the wealthy who do not want their ships, their money, and the rest to leave the family, and so they marry among themselves. See what lies behind these situations, their households. Who made these things? Did God make them?
Did God make them?
Did God make them?
Transgression of God's law carries all these things with it.
We have, he says, a household that is a cross. Our children are unruly. But ask when these children were conceived. Ask whether these children were conceived under the cross, or amid grumbling, or amid blasphemy. Because many parents do not want their children, and they come amid curses and blasphemies against the most holy Theotokos, and so on.
Husbands pressure their wives to abort the children, while the women struggle to keep them, or it may be the other way around. Which children are conceived under the sign of the cross, with prayer, as God wills? Children today are so unruly, they say. But why? Were these children conceived outside God's law?
We must examine these things so that we may discover why we bear these crosses, why these troubles exist in the home.
Why is there all this turmoil and adversity in the home? Why is there such an unbearable cross in the home, weighing upon the individual and the family as a whole? We would uncover many things. I am simply mentioning a few, just to give you a small glimpse, so that we do not ask God for such trials, or try to play the brave hero. But if he does permit it for us, let us gladly carry our cross. Only let us know that we have made the difficulties ourselves, most of us by our own hands. We thought that, against God's law, we could live a life of our own. Why has society today reached this state? Why? Because it lives far from God. It does not want God. It makes its own laws. It abolishes God's laws and makes laws of its own. You hear the campaign promises. You read them. I saw a party platform that says it will legalize abortions, the terminations of pregnancy. In other words, you are meddling in God's affairs, in God's own domain. Your head will be turned upside down, and those who vote for you, who in advance make you into a murderer, will pay for it their whole lives. Are we the ones who make these things? God makes them. God has natural laws and moral laws. And just as those who break the natural laws, put your hand in the fire. You will be burned, drink poison, you will die, grab the live wire, you will be electrocuted, in exactly the same way those who break the moral laws will pay. Behind it all, there is one who keeps the record, an angel and a hand that writes, and unfortunately, it will catch up with us, and we will have to pay. In any case, let us continue. This holy man continues his thought and says, "Whoever does not bear a cross is not worthy to bear a crown. Whoever will not accept to bear a cross is not worthy to bear a crown tomorrow." What is an example? Fasting is a cross for the flesh, because the flesh does not want to fast. For a young man or woman to exercise self-restraint, to enter holy matrimony with honor, and to be worthy of the words, "Crown them with glory and honor," rather than entering dishonored and unworthy of this blessing. That, too, is a cross. Not to cheat with your mouth, not to cheat with your measuring rod, not to cheat with your scale, not to cheat with your measure. This is a cross to stand within what is lawful. If you break it, you will reap the consequences. Do not expect a crown. You got married, you are called to bear the cross of married life. And with God's help, to bear the children that God will give you.
whether he gives you one or none, or five or ten, or two or three. This is the cross of the family, the cross of married life. When you cast aside this cross and begin to subject everything to human calculation, taking pencil and paper, counting, weighing, writing things down, and so on, then do not expect a crown. You must bear the cross of married life, the cross of self-restraint, the cross of chastity, the cross of honor, and the cross of truth, if you are to hope for a crown. Otherwise, do not expect a crown. Whoever throws away these crosses and says, I have no need of virginity, I have no need of self-restraint, I have no need of chastity, I have no need of fasting, I have no need of raising children, I have no need of raising children, I have no need of all this, that person should not expect a crown. You will pass through the furnace through this great week, but you recognize that then you would be entitled to a crown. If you read the life of the Holy 40, you will see that all those who went into that frozen lake of Sebaste received a crown. 40 they were, and 40 angels above them, each one carrying the crown for each of them. One deserted, he left. At the last moment, the angel drew that crown back. The deserter did not receive his crown, because he did not struggle to the end. He did not remain faithful to the end. He lost heart. And indeed, tradition says that the guard, who was of another faith, seeing the crown hovering and remaining there with no one to take it, ran and went in himself and died there, this unbeliever, and he received that crown. And so it is not all tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la. Nor is it about putting on the skimpy little swimsuit and going out to show off our figures, nor about what the world will say of us, how we look as we stand before the mirror. God does not want these things. If we were not going to die, then we could do whatever we pleased. But since we are going to die, woe to us, one day we shall pass through what people commonly call God's reckoning. And there everything will be weighed and everything revealed. God is long-suffering, but he does not forget. Those are two different things. He forgives, but he does not bless what is wrong. He waits for each person to return and put things right. He does not desire the death of the sinner. Indeed, many of us who have returned, myself included, hardened offenders before Christ, say inwardly at every moment, My God, why did you not permit me to be killed all those times in war, to be shipwrecked at sea, or to fall to my death from the air? For I would not merely have gone to hell by the life I was living. I would have fashioned a special hell for myself, and I would have gone there all the sooner. Yet God's long-suffering found ways, and perhaps he saw that I would repent, so that I would return and today wage a small struggle, that I might be saved. This is who God is. He has not changed. God does not desire the death of the sinner, but we imagine that either he does not exist or he cannot act, and that is exactly why his justice does not go into effect. He both can and does exist, but he is long-suffering once. On another occasion, when I was speaking about the things that are found within the church, and what each one symbolizes and calls to mind, I said the following on this point, and I say it now for those who either do not remember it or are hearing it for the first time. Within the church, everything is present, and indeed everything up to the second coming and the judgment is symbolized there. And I say, at the feet of the honorable forerunner, there is an axe. This is the justice of God. For someone to cut with the axe, he must take it up in his hand. No one has taken it up yet. It just sits there. Indeed, John, when he saw the ugly things happening in his own days, said to the scribes and Pharisees that the one coming after him would take it up and clean the threshing floors. But he came, and not only did he not clean the threshing floors, they cleaned him off as well. It was not yet the time. This is the justice of God that sits there, but a day will come when he will take it up in his hand, and then the dry wood will be separated from the green. He will clean all these things up, and this is brought home to us even more by the icon of the Lord enthroned. You have the icon of the Lord enthroned, the Pantocrator, our Christ, seated, and so on. There are the judgments. And if you look at that icon of the Lord above it, as I was saying, no lamp burns with oil. There is no oil there. whereas everywhere else, on the iconostasis and elsewhere, the most holy Theotokos, the Lord, the saints, all have the lamp with oil in front of them, and it burns. There the lamp does not burn, the oil does not burn there. Why? Because there it is judgment, and in judgment there is no mercy here. Here at the beautiful gate the reconciliation will be made, by the intercessions of the Theotokos. O Savior, save us, O God. And when a person accepts Christ, repents, makes holy confession, comes to the beautiful gate to receive his body and his blood for the forgiveness of sins and life eternal, then he is set right and passes through the beautiful gate into the kingdom of heaven. That is why it is called the beautiful gate. It is from there that the souls will pass. They do not pass by way of the coffee house, nor through someone's embrace, nor by the cruise, nor by traveling abroad, nor by the sea, nor by the mountain, nor through the side doors. Here is where they will pass. There is no other way. On either side of this iconostasis stand two archangels, keeping watch and guarding the doors. And should a person want to go through, saying, I will do well and I will speak, from there he will be told, Sir, in the middle you will be sent from here. Go and take it up with these two, the new Eve and the new Adam, who came and replaced the first Adam and the first Eve. Be reconciled with them so that they may give you the ticket for the kingdom of heaven. Because if you are not reconciled now, while mercy is being shown here before the... Be reconciled so that they may give you the ticket for the kingdom of heaven. For if you are not reconciled now, while mercy is being shown here before the beautiful gate at the Solius, one day you will come there to the judgment, and then there will be no mercy. There is nothing within our church that does not remind a person of something and that does not teach him. But we are careless, we are uncatechized, we are indifferent toward these matters, and each of us issues a certificate for himself. You know what I do and you know who I am, and may you do the same and be that too and others as well. The wife issues the certificate of absolution for the husband for the wife, for the mother-in-law, for the grandmother. You know what kind of people they were, and what am I? But what are these things you are telling me? As if others can stand in for you. Christianity is not contagious. It is the personal affair of each individual. What follows from this? Adam made the first two children, Cain and Abel. The one was a murderer, and the other was good. What are you telling me now? Were they not from one womb? Were they not from one mother? Did they not grow up together out there in the fields? And so on. And so with these two, one was a murderer, and the other was not. So what are you telling me now about kinship, about who their relatives are, and about issuing certificates on their behalf? Do such certificates count for anything? Will Christ make a mistake? Will God judge a person unjustly? No, that is not how it is. And so a person must absolutely digest these things and take care to live them in this world and to accept what God permits for him. Otherwise, if he wants it his own way, he will not get there. All these religions of ours that we fashion to our own measure have only hell. They have no paradise. All of these gentlemen who present themselves as religions, whether they are called Papists or Protestants, or Jehovah's Witnesses, or Muslims, or Buddhists, or Zoroastrians, and so on and so on. Their religion has only hell. It has no paradise. Paradise belongs only to Jesus, the crucified one, the Nazarene, his religion, the one whose tomb is empty and whose mother's tomb is empty, the one who rose again. His religion has paradise as well, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. Therefore we will accept it, but we will follow behind Christ. That is why it says here, whoever does not bear a cross is not worthy to wear a crown. The prize comes after the cross. And how beautifully he said it, amen, remember this, on the Sunday after the exaltation of the cross. Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. He speaks of the cross before the cross. Christ had not yet been crucified, and yet he was already speaking of the cross. Every person must bear a cross, crucifying his passions and desires. He must not be so quick to say yes, but must learn to say no. No to his flesh, no to fashion, no to the world, no to the ego, and no to self-interest. No, 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 we are ready, hands up, ready for whatever it asks of us. But then where do we go? Where will it take us for the body? The flesh must be led, and the soul must not be dragged along by the body. The body must not give the orders. It must serve. And if a person could only entertain one thought that I will point out to him, he would have much to gain. He would liken the partnership of soul and body to the dog with the cat. There is not, and there must not be, any reconciliation between these two, because whatever the flesh wants does not benefit the soul, and whatever benefits the soul, the flesh does not want. The soul is the rider, it is the chauffeur, it is the driver. It does not drive where the vehicle wants, the vehicle would take it to the rock. We shall now hear what it says. The flesh asks for this. It is mad. The flesh is mad in what it asks for, what is of no benefit to the soul. And if a person would further take into account that the soul can stand and can live alone without the body, while the body cannot live without the soul, for once the soul is separated, the body begins to return to that out of which it was composed, to stink, and they are ready to bury it, to enter it, then consider where you are being led astray, who it is that leads you astray, and why you would lose eternity for the sake of the temporary, for two carob husks. For the pleasures are carob husks, the pleasures of this world are carob husks. In the parable of the prodigal son, and the prodigal is each one of us, he likened the pleasures of that young man, who squandered his life, to carob husks. Carob husks have a certain property. First, they are not for human stomachs, they are for swine, because of the intemperance that swine have. Lovers of the flesh and so on, they do not fill a person, no pleasure does. Whatever it may be, it has a small sweetness. But then afterward you spit upon that sweetness, you spit upon that pleasure. So it is with the carob husk. When you bite it and chew it, it offers you a certain tastiness, a sweetness. But then you spit it out because it is not for your stomach. So it is also with the sins, with all the sins. And even so, a person looks to gratify himself in his life today with things worse than these that our Christ speaks of with the carob husks. Why does a person today seek to fill himself with carob husks? Because he lives far from Christ. Christ fills all things for him. A person finds his purpose when he follows Christ. He learns where he came from, why he came, and where he is, and he is filled within, he is empty in nothing. Those who supposedly run to catch butterflies, whom we admire, all end up in the madhouse. Some take their own lives, others have no sleep. The asylums have filled up. Were there ever in the world as many asylums as there are today? With such civilization and with man having arrived so far, an arrived man, as he says. I ask you, you are educated people. You live within the world, within knowledge. Were there ever in the world as many madhouses as there are today, even in our own Greece? Abroad, every household has its own psychiatrist. Were there psychiatrists before? Everything has filled up. Look around. You have seen how many asylums there are. Why? Far from Christ. The highest social level, as they call it, is that of Sweden. Do you know how many suicides of young people we have, of both sexes, thousands a year? Why? What are they lacking? They got up in the morning and they have nothing to eat. It is Christ they are lacking. That is why it is necessary for a person to understand this, to accept that here in the world to which he came, he did not come in order to stay. He came in order to depart, and he departs in order to remain. He came in order to die here, and he dies in order to live. Of this kingdom there shall be an end. Of that kingdom there shall be no end. Man does not understand this, and he does not see his own weakness, the weakness of someone who picks a fight with God. One earthquake came, and the children of nobles and the children of kings became beggars in a fraction of a second. They found themselves in tents, and they stank there. Man does not stop to think and say, what am I? Why will I not finally understand it? Why will I not feel it? We go searching for everything, as you now know. I have found a new fashion, they say. Now we will know when the earthquake will happen, and why it will happen, so you will go outside beforehand. Do not pick a fight with God. Submit and stay inside. And the earthquake will do nothing to you, because God has the power to show you his power, just as he has now shown it in Greece. But we do not want to understand it, and that is that. Perhaps this man also has a third view on the matter of man's tribulations and his cross, somewhat more broadly, and he says this, man's lot is heavy, but it is beautiful. It has its difficulties and so on, but it has content. It has content. It is beautiful. Go up to a young woman who is engaged, whose betrothed is abroad. She is certain that in a short while she will fly off to be near him to live the life of her dreams. Go and watch how she works, with what gladness she works, and especially if she is going to buy her ticket with that money in order to travel there. She may even work overtime and do hard work, but she does it with her whole soul, with joy, singing, I would dare to say, because the journey thrills her. She draws strength from the thought that she will fly, and that there where she flies, things will change. She will live near her beloved, near the man of her dreams. She will live another life. Well, these things are lovely and beautiful, and they do take place here in this false world. Such things exist. How man ought to think that, leaving this world behind, he will fly off to a world where there are no tears, where there is no pain, where there is neither tribulation nor sighing. Why does he conduct himself so mindlessly? Why, it means he does not want God. He does not believe in God. And furthermore, he does not believe in all those things which this God promises. He does not believe that there are things beyond the grave. He relies simply on his own reason and listens to certain educated, atheistic scientists who have erased God and exalted man. They have erased the Creator and made a God of the inventor. You know, on the basis of the inventions that have been made today throughout the world, where truly the mind of man stands high, on the basis of this, they erased God. Today, man is God, but is man a creator or an inventor? That is the question. Tell me what happened with what man has discovered today. He found laws that work wonders in relation to the faster pace of life. Is that not so? He found them. He did not create them. Therefore, there is someone behind it all. Others, in order to reject God, make nature into a God. But nature has no reason. What does nature do? Does it create? Is nature a creator? Nature multiplies, it does not create. I have seen that a donkey produces a little donkey, a dog a puppy, a cat a kitten, a human being a little human being. Is that not so? A fish a little fish, and a bird a little bird. Nature multiplies, it does not create. Consequently, neither nature nor man is a creator. Nature multiplies while man invents, therefore, there is a creator. Instead of him, there is someone who made these things, someone who set them in place, and you and I found them today. But man, being an egoist, erases God and makes a God of himself. That is who he is. I was speaking with a young surgeon, a proud man. I performed the operation, he told me. I cut, I repaired. Make the sign of the cross and give glory to God, I told him. Now, while you are still young, or one day a patient will die in your hands, then you will lose your medical license, I said, and throw away your scalpel. Aren't you ashamed, I told him. You tell me that you made the incision, but who healed what you cut? Who healed it? Who created it? Who sent all the necessary elements there, the blood and everything else, and healed what you had cut away? How can you fail to see God the Creator at work there, upon your very scalpel? The greatest theologian in the world praises you, for there you see God before your very face. For if he suspends the laws he has set in place, he will make a liar of you. and you will be lost from the very outset while still very young. Are we taking it that far? He tells me. Well, where else are we to take it? Where everything speaks of God in any case. Man's lot is heavy, he says, but it is beautiful, because from Golgotha he will walk toward the resurrection. That is the point, what I told you at the beginning, from pain to blessedness. Man's duty is not to be bent and not to be crushed, because Satan goes and threatens him. Where is your God? If he were your God, would he let you suffer? Would he allow this and that? He would give you, I don't know, golden horses and black riders. Satan says many things. Man's duty, he says, is not to be bent and not to be crushed, but to stand with unshaken faith and the victory of the good. Encouraged by the marvelous example of Christ and watered by his teachings, he must leap over the trial and walk on to victory, embracing tightly the risen Christ. For together with Christ, man can do all things. Christ is a transformer. He transforms grace within each person, and he even modifies each one's pain, tribulation, and difficulty. He eases it, he softens it. For when you turn and look upon the crucified one, you will say, I suffer, I am being crucified. I am ill, I am burning with fever, or whatever it may be, because of my sins. But you suffered so much, and in the end were crucified. You did not murmur, indeed. You even found the occasion to say to God the Father, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I suffered justly, but you suffered without murmuring upon your cross. For, you know, the glory of Christ is not in the resurrection. It is in the cross, and there lies the majesty of Christ. This is why John writes so beautifully, the Holy Spirit was not yet. The Holy Spirit had not yet come, because Christ had not yet been glorified. He had not yet been crucified. He had not yet ascended his throne. For Christ's greatness begins with the cross. And so, to bring this subject to a close, a person must understand this. First, he must take care not to create crosses for himself through his own carelessness, because afterward they are difficult to bear. He becomes resentful, complains, grows indignant, even turns against God, and suffers needlessly. But if God, for reasons known to his providence, allows certain things to be taken from him, money, loved ones, work, and so on, things that would probably have brought harm rather than benefit, then he should say to God, thank you very much, you know, far better than I do. And again, if God permits a temptation to come, we should say what I said earlier, Lord, since you see that this temptation is for my good, the suffering, the tribulations, the hardship, the pain, the illness, the mourning for sin, and the rest, then at least give my shoulders the strength to carry this cross. These things made a deep impression on me when I read them, and I thought I could pass them on to you as well. Perhaps you too may be edified by them, because there is hardly a single person who does not have a problem, not to say who does not have a cross. I pray to the crucified one, through the intercessions of his most holy mother, whose heart a sword pierced beneath the cross, that he may help us too to be edified by these things. Amen.